Well, good evening, and this is Paul Kelly, and you're listening to this Wendy's Speak Up Arkansas show. Speak Up Arkansas started in January of this year, and we're about, I guess we're almost 5 months into it, and I decided today we needed to try as hard as we could to get the listeners engaged, and so I brought in to the studio some people who I know, friends of mine, my rowdy friends, I call them, and they're here to talk about issues affecting the city of Little Rock, the state, and to just talk in general terms about things that we hope our listeners will feel inclined to join us in discussing. This isn't about a particular program. It's about trying to be a forum for a community discussion about things that concern you. I also want to say that always, if there's something you think that we ought to address on Speak Up Arkansas or have an idea for a show or an idea for a speaker, today's you can call in and share that with us, or you can always go to speakupar@gmail.com and send in your comments and let us and leave your contact information, or I guess I'll have your email, so I'll be back in touch with you and be very, very happy to hear your suggestions. We hope to, of course, make subject areas available that are of interest to you and something that you care about. So I want to introduce my guest and remind you that the phones are always open. You can call us at 501-433-0088, and we'll be glad to include you in the conversation. In the studio with me is one of our city directors, Ken Richardson, who has been on the board. This, I think he's in his second four-year term, so his third four-year term. So he has no gray hair, so actually he shaved his head. He probably has gray hair since he's been on there for three terms. But, Ken, I'm glad to have you in the studio today.
Well, thank you, Paul. I'm glad to be here. I think I'm also happy that you consider me one of your rowdy friends. I'm also happy to be in the presence of a couple of my heroes and one of my sheroes. So it's my pleasure being here today with you guys, and hopefully we'll keep everything straight and on par.
Okay. All right. Well, next is Jim Lynch. Now, Jim Lynch is very familiar to, I'm sure, our listeners because he has been so involved in neighborhood programs. And when I was on the city board and anytime there was something that needed to be done, somehow Jim Lynch ended up with a microphone in front of the board or in front of the newspaper. I think we shut down a couple of efforts. We stood in the rain on the roads protesting expansion of the county jail on a couple of times and all kinds of things that you know, I don't really want to talk about because they were I don't know, hard to deal with because of the opposition, but it was always fun. And Jim, I know you were the founder of the Neighborhood Coalition and lots of other things, but glad to have you here with us.
Thank you, Paul, and look forward to today's conversation.
All right. And Judith Faust. Judith Faust is a fellow social worker. She worked at well, actually, I met her back in the 70s when I was a struggling director of a youth service organization, and she parachuted in with a bunch of other smart people to come in and teach us how to be better youth advocates. And Judith went on then, has done all kinds of different things. She was actually on the Planning Commission for a while, wasn't she?
Thanks to Jim Lynch.
Oh, is that right?
Who talked me into it.
Well, that's what you too, huh? That's what happened to me. All right, so people, if you want to run for office, you got to go through Jim Lynch.
That's right.
But Judith, I'm glad to have you here with us.
It's my pleasure.
All right. Well, there's a lot going on, and I think we're here. This is a bit of a free-flowing discussion. We do have some things we want to talk about. But, Ken, I know when I went to pick you up, you were talking about some development in in the city, you want to share what went on today that may be in the news by 5 o'clock tonight, but let's maybe you'll be the first, our audience will be the first to hear this, but tell us what went on.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Unbeknownst to a lot of people right now, maybe they may know it, the other suspect in the killing of the young girl turned himself in today. So we have both of those guys off the street, and I think there's a sigh of relief for the family and the community, and we're all hopeful that the family can get some kind of sense of justice and relief about this young man turning himself in. And makes the community safer, actually.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, you know, that sort of is a good place to start, because I know in the papers there has been concern about the increase in violence and in the city, and I know the police chief has asked citizens to come forth and help with that, and I'd just like to hear your comments and others on what we can do in Little Rock, and for you listeners in the audience, again, you can call at 433-0088 to talk about this for a bit, but what's your perspective on that, Ken?
My point on that, Paul, you know, my adult working life, I did gang intervention prevention work, and I think there's a general frustration with our police department about the community not coming forward to cooperate with them. I think part of it is we don't have any community-oriented policing like we used to do back in the days. And back then, I think the other part of it is we have far too many of our police officers who live outside the city who have no connection with the city. And in some parts of our community, look at protect and serve, while other parts, they look at patrol and control. I think they don't have those kind of relationships, those kind of partnerships with the community that makes them want to cooperate with our police department. I think that's unfortunate. And I think we need to figure out ways to get back to utilizing street-based intervention specialists, workers that can go out there, that the community know, that they know the community, and they could be the bridge between the police department and the community.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Ken has spent a lifetime, as he said, gang intervention and street crime prevention and so forth. He makes the point, as you did, Paul, about community policing. I endorse a heavy emphasis on community policing. And frankly, even though there was a time 15, 20 years ago when some of the senior folks in the LRPD seemed to take community policing seriously, I don't see anything but a waning of that commitment. Chief Buckner's got a hard job, any police chief does in any major city, so I want to say that now. However, at root, in my judgment, community policing is a police reform program, and police departments don't want to reform themselves. We have for years, we've got a nation that relies on automobiles. We've sprawled our communities. We'll talk about that later. But it's the way we live. And so the way we police our community is to buy a Crown Victoria, put a computer in it, put radios in it, put ammunition in it, put guns in it, and put a couple of police armed uniformed policemen in it, and they roll up their windows and they patrol the community. They don't talk to anyone unless they get a call from downtown, and then they get out and enter the fracas, and oftentimes their safety's in jeopardy, as are the lives of some of other people. But my point is this, that the best crime fighting is that crime fighting that stops the crime before it happens.
Yep.
And we don't do any of that. And the way that happens, and I will stay on the radio for days at a time talking about this, but there has to be this element of trust between the people in uniform and the people in the community. And we just don't have it at a sufficient level to where the police understand what some of the problems are in the community and want to work with the community to get them solved. People in the community have to understand what a hard job policing is, because you're on the front lines. You have to make decisions in a millisecond when really tough spots arise. I want to give one example. Judith's got her hand up, but this happened to me about 20 plus years ago. I got a call from a woman. She lives south of Roosevelt. I'd known her for years. And she said, Jim, how are you? I said, fine. She says, I never made this call. I said, I understand. She says, we, now, she used the pronoun we. She said, we have gotten together. There's a young man, and I'm going to, he's a name that's real, not his real name, but she says, I'm going to use Cedric. She says, a young man named Cedric has grown up in our community. We all know him. We know his family and all that. But we, emphasis, we are tired of Cedric. Cedric's a drug dealer. Cedric's destroying lives. He's peddling the worst kinds of stuff all over our neighborhood. And it has gone on for so long, and people are suffering from it and so forth. And she said, you got some paper and pencil? I said, yes. She said, he drives this model car. Here's his license plate number. Here's the address. He makes the deliveries from, you know, his supplier are made on Thursday afternoon. And she says, would you please pass this on to the appropriate authorities? And I said, I'll be happy to. I waited a day or two, went down to the LRPD, introduced myself, and without obviously using names, I said, you need to follow up on this. I never really got a call back, didn't need one, but I think the Cedric problem got solved. But my point is, this woman called me because she trusted me. Now, if we can get to the point where there is this same level of trust between just ordinary citizens and the police about, you know, sort of joining forces to stop these crimes, you know, in this case, after some of them had happened, but, you know, Cedric is going to continue to sell his drugs.
Sure.
And it was interesting. We, the community, had decided we've had enough of Cedric.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's what we need.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And trust is a serious issue. There may be another side to that coin, which is expectations. And we've lived with this disconnection from law enforcement for so long that it's really very hard for communities, for people in neighborhoods, to make clear to the city, to city government, to the police department, what our expectations are of law enforcement. And so, you know, and how does trust get built? It gets built in dialogue, in interaction. So whatever we can do to make more of that happen.
Well, which brings us back to community policing, because that's what it is. And I mean,
of course,
I will be the first to say I have never volunteered nor filled out an application to be a policeman. I mean, I have done other kinds of work. It's hard work. It may not be paid enough, but in this case, I don't think pay is the issue. What we've got to have is they've got to get out of those cars in the particular neighborhoods where we know we need to elevate the level of engagement and trust. And they have got to knock on doors. In effect, they've got to be like the old Fuller Brush salesman. They have got to make cold calls.
Right.
You know, they've got to have that card, and they've got Mrs. Johnson, I'm Patrolman Schmidt, and I will be on your beat for the next several months. Here's my number. Here's my cell phone. Here's my email, and I am here to help with anything you think I can help you with, and I mean walk those streets. We have just never done that in Little Rock, not on a consistent basis.
We had them in the early 90s, we had them on bikes, Jim, and I think the trust issue is really, really critical, because when you have police officers who are actively involved in the community, they do not treat everybody like criminals. They don't put a brand or label on everybody, so they have an opportunity to know those who are committing the crimes and those who are regular law-abiding citizens. They know who's there, and the police can have a way to identify those people, and the people in the community know them. That's really, really critical, that they feel like they can depend on them. It's hard for them to cooperate when they don't feel like you're going to cooperate back. They can't depend on you. If you treat them like criminals, I think that they're not going to look at you as a friend or somebody that can help them do whatever issues they have. And there's a lot of social ills. I think one of you guys has made the point. We know based on demographics where the crime is going to happen. We know that. And I think by our understanding, collective understanding, these issues, we're not going to be able to police our way out of them. We can't police our way out of unemployment, underemployment. There are certain issues that we need to address from a social standpoint. And back to Jim's point about the chief determining whether or not we have community-oriented policing. This comes from the city board level. This would be a policy.
That's my point.
This is something we need in terms of directing our funding and mandating for our police department to engage and embrace. It's not the police department's responsibility. We know it's a hard job, difficult job. But I think from the board level, we need to make it absolutely clear that we need to have, we want to have community-oriented policing from a policy level, from a funding level.
Operational level. Yeah.
All right. I want to remind you, you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas. You can join the conversation by calling 501-433-0088.
Oh.
We have a caller.
Well, yay.
All right.
You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling about the police in the community and how to get our police more involved. I grew up, my parents had a pharmacy on 12th Street at Pine and Cedar, and we always had a wonderful community involvement with our police. They were always around. They were on bikes. The neighborhood knew who they were and how to get a hold of them. And this was in the early 80s and early 90s. And then my family sold the business and we moved out of that community. But my problem now is I live in Hillcrest, just off of Markham, and I hear gunshots on a regular basis, a couple times a month. I try to call 911, and no one answers.
Oh, my.
Or there's a busy signal, or I'm put on hold. And another problem I have is hearing that the police, if we're wanting them to be more involved in our communities, why don't they live in our community?
Great point.
What is with the neighborhoods that you hear about in outside of the county that are Little Rock police neighborhoods, basically, where you have a large population of police that don't even live in the areas where they're policing? Right. And that's just really frustrating for me because I don't have any problems with our police force except when I see things like, the 911, and then also seeing things like blatant running of red lights, and there's a police officer sitting right there. Yeah. Accidents could have happened. Nothing is done. Right. It's really frustrating. I don't know at what level I, as a citizen, am able to, or how I get involved in that. But I'd really love to hear your comment.
Well, caller, if you live in Hillcrest, call your city director, Kathy Webb, and tell her what you think about this. Kathy is a very capable public official, and you elect her. She represents the Hillcrest area, and let her know what you think. I don't think we need to call Ken Richardson. He's on board, but some of these other directors have got to move this issue of community policing higher up on the totem pole things we're going to do.
The caller also has three other representatives on the board, the three in at-large positions.
Right.
So you got four folks on the city board who are there representing you. And, you know, it's worth getting to know those folks. It's worth making the call.
And can I weigh in? I think if I understand, the pharmacy you talked about is now part of our 12th Street station. Is that the correct location? It had a pharmacy attached to that thrift store building. And I think it's part of our 12th Street substation right now. The other thing you just mentioned, to me, you know, we keep having an emphasis on more police officers filling the vacancy there. We have a large number of vacancies in the 911 call center that we need to have more aggressive efforts of trying to fill that. You know, here's the really interesting part I hear. Just recently at the funeral of the little 3-year-old kid that was killed, the first thing our city manager said, this is an issue we cannot police our way out of. I heard the chief say at the site of the scene of a double shooting, two teenagers got shot. First thing he said, this is something we cannot police our way out of. Yet and still, when we talk about it from a policy standpoint, they attribute the uptick in crime with the vacancies in the police department. So you can't have one and the other. And how we commit our resources. Just the other day, I saw a high-speed chase with seven police officers behind one car. What is car number 5, 6, and 7 going to do that 1, 2, and 3 can't do? I saw an incident a week ago where there was a domestic dispute. It wasn't physical. They just arguing. We had six police officers, six police cars parked in front of that house. How do we allocate our resources? And that may be part of the reason why we're not able to solve some of these crimes in our community, because we don't have a real strategic way of allocating these resources that we have available to us.
Well, it's a good thing we didn't have a helicopter, or they'd have been there, too.
Yeah, I remember that.
All right.
Thank you, caller, for calling on this,
and hope this was helpful.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Great point.
Yes. Again, 433-0088. Let's turn a little bit to the issue about the homeless. That's something that's been in the paper. I know there's a committee working on that. That's what was in the at least the article in the paper today. And
trying to get my blood pressure up, Paul. So.
Okay. but I used to help Robert Johnson feed the homeless, and mm-hmm. I remember my favorite thing was when they took us away from under the bridge, we decided, well, heck, we'll go into City Hall and do it. And so we did that, and I'll be darned if the next thing I knew, we had a nice air-conditioned place at a church down the street. So I know that there are a lot of good people trying to serve them, and I don't want to get you, since your blood pressure's up, you want to talk, it may help.
Yes, it's down now as I looked at Jim and he gave me a high five. To me, this is one of the most idiotic issues that we dealt with at the city. We're talking about charging people or criminalizing people for helping people who need this kind of help. The people who need the help that are least of us, we're trying to charge people to do that. We're trying to criminalize people to do that. And the whole makeup, I think I was the only one who voted last week against the formulation of this committee, because I thought it was, one, nobody has explained to me what the issue is. What is the rationale for doing it? If it's a public safety issue, based on all the officers who showed up at that domestic abuse case, we can have enough officers sit out in the parks and kind of monitor those parks. If it's a cleanliness issue, I see all kinds of parks in our city that don't have homeless feeding programs that need some cleaning up. And I just, to me, it still hasn't been made clear to me why we're trying to do this. I don't understand it. You know, this notion of having this posse in place where we charge people.
I have a guess.
Jim, think about this. This whole policy piece they're trying to put in, this process, they're only going to be allowed to feed them twice a year. I can support that if the homeless people agree to only get hungry twice a year.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, and somebody mentioned to me, another reporter, that they want to have this kind of policy where they want to put them off all in one piece of land. And I said, that's crazy. It sounds like a plantation. How would they have access to supports and services that they need? I mean, there's no one single cause of homelessness. And there's a lot of social ills in our community that contributes to that. And I think this is one of the most idiotic things I've seen us deal with since I've been on the board. And I've seen us deal with a lot of things.
So that committee met this morning at 7:30?
7:30.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think they've had committees discuss this several times, so I don't know what new they're going to.
What is the problem?
The issue of how to feed them or where to feed them. Yeah.
What is the issue? It hasn't been made clear to me, Paul.
No.
What is the issue? Are we having violent acts? I mean, what is the issue?
Well, I think the issue is...
People don't want to
somebody
look at
doesn't want to see him.
Right.
I'll let y'all say that.
And, that's my job here. And, I don't know quite what to do in the face of that, except that I see homeless people and their advocates doing a good job of trying to stand up to what our esteemed representative is called idiocy.
what was the policy that you could rotate them among all the parks, and you could feed them in each park twice a year?
So we don't have to.
As long as you went from park to park.
Well, that makes sense.
Well,
not.
If you fed them out in a reservoir park, there's no homeless people in reservoir park.
It seemed like the makeup of the committee was real limited geographically, but homelessness is not limited geographically. And it's hard for me to convince people that not everyone is motivated by $100,000 a year salary, a big home, or the fanciest car you can get. A lot of people are motivated and get inspired by helping the least of these. A lot of people get their joy in life by helping people. And that's unbelievable to a lot of people in our community, because a lot of people are not driven by the same kind of spirit to give back to the community. A lot of us are driven by my salary, my bank account, and where I live, the size of my home, and the make and model of my car. And I mean, that's just frustrating to me. It hasn't been made clear to me. And I think you're right. I want to get them out of sight, out of mind. And the issue, I haven't seen one particular reason why we're doing this.
Why we're even doing it in the first place.
In the first place. Right. I mean, I don't think the committee is going to come up with something that's still not going to, it's not going to mirror what we're doing already. The committee suggests that something is wrong. So whatever they do, it's not going to evolve. It's going to devolve
Hello?
Into something not
committed. Can I chime in?
Yes, please do.
All right. I want to just expound upon something. This comment the gentleman made about people being motivated by helping people. I couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that's going to last.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's the only thing that's going to last. And you know, if you really think about it, that's what's missing in a lot of people's lives that so-called have made it.
Absolutely.
You're talking about the big salary, the big house, and the big car, and what now? You know?
Yep.
Remember the Christmas story? It's been called A Christmas Carol and Scrooge and all that kind of stuff. Okay, now here's the thing. This guy had the biggest house in London or wherever he was out.
Right.
If you knew him, you owed him money. He owned everything.
Right.
Okay? But remember that place he lived, and it was a big old creepy and creaky and cobwebs and cold, and he was all by himself.
Right.
He spent Christmas Eve sitting there eating soup in front of a fireplace, right?
Right.
And when he woke up, remember, he thought he died. Remember the last dream he had? He thought he died and went to hell.
Yep.
And when he woke up, he was so happy. He was so happy that he had another chance. What's the first thing he did? He went out there on that balcony. He called that young boy. He says, you know that big duck? Go buy that. And here's money for you. And he's going to give it to that man, that Bob Cratchit. His son was Tiny Tim. Because in one of those dreams, he dreamed that Tiny Tim had died. And he gave that big goose to that family, had Christmas with them, and gave him a big fat raise and started giving stuff away. And that's when he became a satisfied man. And that was the most important day of his life.
Absolutely.
Caller?
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Don't hang up yet. You have any ideas about how to get more people interested in, engaged in helping?
Engaged in helping.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think people being involved in events, you know, it's one of those things you're not sure if you're going to like it until you do it.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's one of the things. I know we can't mention brands and stuff on the air and so forth, and I won't mention the name of my business, but I've been working in the business world for about 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that one thing that the business I work with, we do, is we go out and cook out for people.
Ah.
We cook out at churches and businesses and schools, and we've fed about 25,000 people
Fantastic.
In 2.5 years.
Fantastic.
And I spent most of the time behind a computer looking at charts and graphs and analysis and all this stuff. But I want to tell you something. The happiest part of my day is when we cook out for somebody.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When we go out there in the public and I hand somebody a hamburger or a hot dog and a bag of chips and say, have a nice day. I can't put a price on that.
Absolutely.
But I want to tell you something. It makes me feel good inside.
Yeah.
And that's
it makes me feel better than anything, raise, promotion,
absolutely.
Or thing
you absolutely.
That I can buy.
Well, you hit the nail on the head.
So just encourage people to get involved in events like that, whatever
absolutely.
They may be. You know, I mean, some of the happiest people I've ever met are people that work at the hospital and volunteer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thanks for what you do.
They just want to help people. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got two social workers in the room. I may be incorrect, but is it not true that a very high percentage of people on the streets, homeless people, have some mental affliction?
I read that.
And so it's. Yeah. I mean, no one would. I don't think anybody would choose to live in a cardboard box underneath a bridge.
No.
Well, you're right.
But their lives are disorganized.
Yeah.
They have some dysfunction either within themselves or their family, and so they're just really up against it.
Right.
Moving them around.
You just move.
I mean, isn't going to do a darn bit of good.
I think you're right.
A lot of people in this country are one paycheck away from being homeless.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
You know, I read that 35% of all households live paycheck to paycheck. A lot of people are within one job loss or major illness from being bankrupt.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it's easy to look at people like this and say, well, that's their own fault. They did that to themselves. They had opportunities.
Absolutely.
Blah, blah, blah. But let me tell you something. I'll close with this. The tallest any human being will ever stand is when they're bending down to help their fellow man.
Yes, sir. And I would just
all
like...
All right, I have to listen. Thank you so much.
Get an amen to that.
Amen.
Amen.
Can
amen.
I get
thank
one quick
buddy.
Point
bye-bye.
In, Paul?
Yeah, go
I
ahead.
I think that one of the other things to answer Judith's question is, one of the things they can do is put pressure on us, your city board members, your elected officials, to say, this is crazy. Don't go down this path. I mean, continue that advocacy and that work on behalf of the least of these. One of the things, Jim, you made reference to our social workers, and a lot of people do this work not for finances, not for name recognition, not to be acknowledged or recognized for any pats on the back. They do it because they have a genuine concern about the least of these. And not only are some of these people having mental health issues, some of them have substance abuse and use mm-hmm. issues. So it requires some substance abuse treatment. It's a whole host of issues rather than just giving them food or handing them a place to stay. There are a number of issues that we need to help them address them as a community from a comprehensive standpoint.
And some of them are veterans.
And
like, too many of them are veterans.
Well, and like it or not, they're part of the community. And, you know, Ken, I think, made this the most salient point. Why are we doing this? I think Judith answered. It's because, you know, some folks don't even want to see them. You don't get to choose who's a part of the community.
Absolutely.
Oh, really? I'm not sure everybody understands.
Well,
that,
that point needs to be made clearer in some way.
All right. Well, we're going to thank you for the call in. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with you on Speak Up Arkansas.
Well...
My new friend Red Adelina Golden Dark. She's got night train. Take the chill right out your bones. Got some old mohair coats. Wrap down everything I own. Yeah, quarter day, quarter.
That was Baba Mall singing Dakar Moon.
Nice.
All right. Ken, we're going to stay in Little Rock, and then we're going to go on a more philosophical discussion. But, again, this is a call-in show, 501-433-0088. You're on the air with Speak Up Arkansas. I've got Ken Richardson, Jim Lynch, and Judith Faust, and I'm Paul Kelly, the host for today's show. So,
and if y'all don't call in, you won't hear anything but our voices.
That's right.
You need to speak up. Yeah, Ken, let's close a little bit on the issue about crime. I know it's bigger than just the police. Say what you'd like to.
Yeah, Paul, that's one of the things I've been trying to deal with my colleagues on. I think we need to have a paradigm shift in terms of how we address public safety. A lot of people, unfortunately, we address public safety through more police and bigger jails. That's not the case. From my direct service work doing gang intervention prevention programming, one of the things I noticed that gangs were strongest where sense of community was weakest. Crime was strongest where sense of community was weakest. Healthy communities do not have disproportionate number of liquor stores, a disproportionate number of convenience stores that contribute to some of the ills, social ills in our community. They do not have a disproportionate number of boarded up, abandoned homes, vacant homes that become trap houses. And trap houses mean these are places where a lot of criminal activity emanate. So I think we need to redefine how we address public safety and have a little bit more comprehensive conversation. It's not just more police, it's not but bigger jails. Crime is more prevalent and strongest in where senses where community is weakest. And we look at those areas, like we can map right now where the next criminal acts are going to occur. Violent acts as well.
Right, right. And we don't have after school and summer programs that keep them, with something positive.
Amen, sir.
Too,
so. And adequate employment opportunities.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. All right, well, I think one of the things we wanted to talk a little bit about, all of us read an article that I captured from the I think it was Politico, and it was actually concerning the issue of intolerance. You know, we talk about how divided the state is, how divided our politics are, how divided our beliefs about religion and individual rights. And, this article, I think, was really informative. I'm going to read a brief summary I wrote about it just to get the discussion started. But the article actually begins by noting recent events at liberal college campuses that threatened or prevented a conservative political scientist, a conservative commentator, and a conservative writer from speaking on their campus. Causing, I think, the issue to talk about intolerance among liberals. It asks the question, are conservatives more prejudiced than liberals or vice versa? It addressed this question with a series of findings from scholarly and professional research conducted over the years on this issue and highlighting more recent research on the topic. Some of the findings were the assumption has been that social conservatives and religious fundamentalists possess psychological traits such as the value of conformity and the desire for certainty that tend to predispose people towards prejudice. Meanwhile, the liberals and the non-religious tend to be more open to new experiences, a trait associated with low prejudice. But it's not that simple.
That's not the case.
The new research shows that all of these groups are about equally prejudiced against those with opposing views. The intolerance seems to contradict also some of the core values held by these same groups. For example, conservatives highly value self-reliance, which is associated with freedom to believe or do what you want. And liberals highly value universalism, which espouses acceptance of all. So it sort of points out that we're all being hypocrites in our actions for what we say we stand for.
Oh, no.
And intolerance based on religions versus non-religious seems to be based on the strength of the perceiver's religious belief and how far on the non-believer spectrum you are. Religious and non-religious have their own set of targets of intolerance, driven primarily by seeing the opposing groups as limiting one's personal freedom. The same can be said for intelligence. Intelligence did not correlate with overall levels of prejudice. There were just different targets of their intolerance. Political orientation was the same, especially against those holding positions of opposite social views, because cultural issues are more visceral than those that involve economics or political ideologies. And I think the article says, and this is very true, that it's a simple fact, that a fact of humanity, that we like people similar to us, members of our own group. Openness is not a prejudice antidote. Openness to new experiences correlate with lower prejudice against a collection of social groups, but it increases the prejudice that open-minded people have against closed-minded
people.
So what to do? What to do? You know, the article talked about we need to have more contact with people in the other side, sharing experiences and working on a common goal. That's one of the things that we can do. And I think that breaks down in small areas and on different issues across the communities. You know, and, you know, we can start with our neighbor if we can find our neighbor that happens to disagree with us, because everybody likes to live around people they would like us to. So.
Right. And we may disagree about the occupant of the White House, or we may disagree about policies related to gay marriage, but we all want safety in our communities. We all want the trash picked up and the street swept. We all want our kids, actually research shows, we all want our kids to have clean air and clean water. Whatever we say we believe about climate change. So, this is a tough one. I'm old, and I've watched a lot over a long time.
You're about to get mad at me, because I was about to say I'm much younger than you guys.
You are.
And I may be wrong on this. I think that, in my opinion, I think it's okay for us to disagree with each other. I think that makes us a healthy community. Where
of
it becomes
course.
Negative or positive is how we express that disagreement. It's natural for us to disagree with each other, but the expression of the disagreement determines whether it's right or wrong, positive or negative.
Right.
Whether you're disagreeable in expressing your disagreement.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But the phenomenon that I think I see, maybe I don't, is that the depth of the division between liberals and conservatives in this country has grown. And there's not a lot of talking going on across that gap. And that feels qualitatively different to me. And you're talking about a survivor of, protests about civil rights,
right,
and protests about the war in Vietnam. And I'm no stranger to civil discord, but I worry about the level of intolerance that progressives have for conservatives and conservatives for progressives.
And I think the media plays a part in this,
point.
Because
Absolutely.
It is entertainment.
Absolutely.
It is sort of a, I call it sick, I guess, a way of being entertained by seeing this.
Well, it's not news. I agree. And listen, audience, I'm not that much younger than him. I'm right up.
A whippersnapper.
Here, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that how it gets exacerbated in my mind is we have entertainment that masks itself as news, and it caters to those views of the opposing views. So you have people who tune into those, and regardless of how off-centered it is, they embrace that, and that drives them to their belief system and how they act and how they think and believe. There are some people who live by entertainment that they get from news channel. By the law, they live by it like it's a Bible in of itself.
But are you sure this isn't a chicken or egg controversy? Which came first?
That's beyond my pay grade.
Yeah.
Well, it's a sad time. If I knew how, all our groups, people, individuals, communities, interest groups could disagree without being disagreeable, I would certainly bottle it, sell it, become a trillionaire. So I don't know how to talk or teach them to do that. I will say it's so disappointing. I mean, we now have a president who just won the White House by capturing this notion of entertainment and spectacle.
Was opportunistic.
He's obviously not interested. He never thought he would win. He really didn't. I mean, that's been documented. He was stunned when the results came in from those last three states. He played it just close enough in those three states to be within reach. And I think the truth is that, unbeknownst to millions of people, I'll say the 63 million people that voted for Mrs. Clinton, unbeknownst to them, there was another effort that enough of the 61 million people who decided to take a chance on him, that it wasn't so much that he was great. They knew he didn't have any experience.
Well,
and,
sure.
And this whole thing of, disagreeing, being disagreeable. He ran one of the most disagreeable campaigns in the history of the nation.
Absolutely.
But there was an orchestrated effort to run down Mrs. Clinton. I never heard it. I never believed that Hillary Clinton was running a heroin network. I never believed that she orchestrated Vince Foster's murder.
Stop.
But that stuff was going around, and that captured, and it went around and around and around, and it penetrated enough that in the advertising game, if you hear a message so many times and you're still tuning in, you start to believe it.
Well,
my point is, now we have a leader. We have a leader whose habit is to absolutely be disagreeable. There's nothing agreeable about the guy's rhetoric. There's nothing agreeable about the guy's willingness to see the other side. His first issue in office was, my crowd was 1.5 million people. Well, no, it wasn't, President. It was one of the smallest ever.
Okay.
But let's look at here's another take on this. We, and I use the we now to talk about liberals and progressives and middle-of-the-road Democrats, we weren't listening. And
I'm not going to listen to Hillary Clinton. Somebody saying something about Hillary Clinton that's clearly a lie.
No, we weren't listening to the people who felt abandoned and lost, and who went for this untried, untested, obviously questionable candidate because they thought that maybe he would stand up for them, would hear them. And I think, Jim, I think we've got to own that.
Yeah, there.
The part, I understand all of that. Politics is responding. It's like anything else. You've got to listen, and then you've got to respond. And I think this gets back to some of what Paul was trying to peel out of the article. This argument that I have heard about or read about this group that feels so beleaguered and left behind, that this notion of they're tired of being political correct and Donald Trump was not politically correct and that's what they liked about him. Well, you know, politically correct. I mean, you tell a racist joke in front of the city board or down at the squad call in at the police department. You know, it's not cool to laugh at the racial joke.
No, that's reprehensible.
And they're tired of this?
But the issue isn't really isn't the racist jokes. The issue let me finish a point here. The issue is what it feels like if you've worked, if you're the third generation person in your family who's worked in coal. And coal is not the wave of the future. And I think those folks looked at the Democratic Party and Democratic politicians, and all they heard from them was, coal's dead.
Well, and let me chime in real quickly and briefly. I think Paul's point about entertainment strikes a real chord in me, because you had people who actually supported him, who actually thought that he had their best interests at heart.
Absolutely.
He's been so far removed, so far disconnected from the people who put him there. And that's the entertainment part that actually make you think that here's a man who's been a millionaire, billionaire his whole life, has some kind of connection, some kind of appreciation for you and what you've gone through. It's the biggest disconnect in the world. I think we can blame the entertainment part on that. Because he's so far removed from the people who actually put him there. It's laughable. I mean, it just drives me crazy when I think about it.
And I will not be dissuaded from this point. I'm not asking anyone in the studio or out in the listening audience to agree with me. But I will forever agree.
Stolen.
I will forever assert that much of his vote was an anti-Obama vote. Much of his vote was an anti-black vote.
I do not
vote.
Amen. Disagree.
Amen.
Well, I think it absolutely
that's a sad, sad commentary on our nation.
Well, the question is, what do we do about it? Right. And that is what I think Judith's point is, too. I do think we didn't listen. We dismissed a large segment of the population. My God, they had to deal with racism, they had to deal with LGBT, they had to deal with
a terrible recession,
had to deal with things, and were all this new stuff and all this different way of looking at things. There was
a lot to absorb.
And they all got, they have and still do have white privilege, so they did not recognize why, in fact, all this
day.
Was going on, because it wasn't what they thought it would be, and it was something
they signed up for.
It's not what they signed up for. So,
I'm finally an expert at something as the only black person in here.
Ken.
I agree with Jim wholeheartedly that a lot of this is anti-Obama.
I do too.
You're talking about make our country great again, take our country back. Take it back from who?
Yeah.
I don't think there's no way in the world
brown
that he could have gotten elected if he was coming on the heels of a white president.
Al Gore.
There's no way in the world. And I think as a black man, I agree with you, Jim. And thanks for bringing it up,
so
my friend.
Too.
Well, and then he ran this birther lie for a good 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
Sure.
Which just, out of nowhere.
All right.
I'm just asking, how do we move on?
That's
from
a great
here?
Point.
How
yeah.
do we?
Yeah. What do we do about it? Listeners, call in. We're puzzled. Please help us. Help us. We got six minutes left. We'd like to hear from
well,
our
as,
listeners.
As one of three white people in the studio, this is not original with me. I read an article a long time ago.
And we're all retired.
And it was not.
Retired white people.
The topic of the article was something similar to what we're talking about today. And it was written by a white woman, but she had come to the conclusion that white people really need to listen to the black narrative.
Yeah.
And
hello,
don't.
You're on the air.
Yeah, they don't.
Right.
You going to help
Hi.
Us? Yeah. Go
Thanks
ahead.
For taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to pose a question to your panel. My name's Andy. You guys probably know me, Andy Burns.
Hey, Andy.
Of you guys know me. I wonder if you could talk about the possibility that some of the reasons why Hillary lost was because she and that side of the Democratic Party did not listen to sort of to put it into a simple box, the Bernie wing, the sort of more democratic socialist wing of the Democratic Party. And I'll let you guys discuss that.
I'm nodding like crazy.
Yeah, well, I think you had three Bernie voters around the table here, but go ahead.
Well,
not you.
Okay.
No.
I'll hang up now. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Andy.
We're nodding, but we're not going to fight Jim on this. We'll let Jim.
Well, actually, I wouldn't have said this on when the election was November 9th. So I would not have said this on the morning of November 10th because I was sort of disappointed, mad, confused, and all of that sort of stuff. But this is several months later. The Democrats made a big mistake nominating Mrs. Clinton, not because she wasn't able to be president. She clearly was, had the credentials, had the motivation, the spirit. It really has nothing to do with Mrs. Clinton herself.
Absolutely.
It has to do with is the political equation of when you're choosing your leaders, city, county, federal, senior level, United States of America, even the world, it is never a good reason to nominate someone because it's their turn. And that's what the Democrats right. did.
Well, and I think the country wanted a change, because I think that was the big issue, too. There, we needed a change, and she was seen as...
Well, she was taking her turn. It was not a change of any kind.
Right. Yeah, just handing off like a baton relay race. Right. Well, I mean, that speaks to the point about we need to have more people running for office.
Indeed.
We need to have more people voting. We need to have make sure we get the right kind of people in office that express the views of all of us, not that it's just a status quo, it's not part of the machine, not part of the team. So we need to make sure we're getting these people out to run that represents a variety of views that's not part of the machine, and get them involved, and so we can change the politics direction of our community, whether it's a city, county, or state. And I think that I'll say this last thing, and I promise you I'll be quiet. I think Paul did us all a disservice. I don't think Paul realized how garrulous this artist was going to be. He realized we could talk so much.
Oh,
and
he was
not well. He should have expanded his show another hour, because we still got stuff to say. We only got 2 minutes left.
Well, so and you've gotten us a few calls, so I appreciate that. We do just have a few minutes left. I want to say Speak Up Arkansas purpose is to reach out to this community and hear come and be a place where voices that are not being heard get a chance to be. And I really encourage you, if you'd like to have a subject or like to be a speaker or have some ideas about what we can do for a program on Speak Up Arkansas, please contact me at speakupar@gmail.com, and I'll pay attention to it, and we'll listen. But I do think you made a good point, Ken. Judith?
I've got three quick things in closing here. One is, if you're not registered to vote, register. The second is, think hard about running for public office, and think about the people you know who ought to run for public office and help them do that. The third one is, look for intolerance in yourself.
Great.
And be aware of it and tone it down.
Absolutely.
So that we can begin to talk more with each other.
And don't be afraid to step outside of your lanes. Step outside your box you put around yourself. That'll help you grow and develop to a complete human being.
Jim, what's your advice?
Well, I think Judith has got the right way. We need better candidates running. And, you know, the truth is, what was the number on November 9th? 54% voted.
Pitiful.
Half the country didn't vote, which means that Mr. Trump got in with about one out of four.
Right.
Well, Judith Faust, thank you for being here. Jim Lynch, good to see you again. I know we will our paths will cross now that you're back in the country from your travels. And Ken, so good to see you and hear from you, and I do appreciate your work on the board. I know you're asking people to come in and run for office to try to get out the long-timers. You better watch out.
Yeah.
There are lots of long-timers out there and lots of short-timers that need to go.
Yep.
It is important that you not only vote, but you vote and you do something else, which is to follow up. When you see something you don't like, let them know.
Speak up.
And you're listening... Thank you. And that's the end of this version of Speak Up Arkansas. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you,
Paul.
Hi, this is Alanis Morissette, and you're listening to KABF 88.3 in Little Rock, the voice of the people.
It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we will share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, Chewing the Fat with Rex and Paul, interviews with some of your favorite musical artists on Arkansas Sounds, content from the Butler Center's collections, information about what's happening in the library system, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocals@cals.org. This program is presented